This is an ABC podcast.
It's sometimes difficult to know where to start when you have a program of diverse topics. Hello, welcome to Future Tense. Anthony Fennell here. So let's hammer the tent peg in right here.
My name's Kai Riemer. I'm Professor of Information Technology and Organisation at the University of Sydney Business School.
And the topic up for discussion is free speech in the modern digital age. Professor Riemer has a different and nuanced perspective to share, specifically about what he calls algorithmic audiencing.
We tend to think about free speech exclusively in terms of censorship, content moderation, deleting speech from platforms such as Twitter or Facebook. And to us, my colleague Sandra Peter and I, there's something much more hidden, much more novel at work, and that is algorithms. Not the algorithms that platforms use to delete content, to basically weed out the awful stuff, but algorithms that decide what each of us get to see in our newsfeed. And those algorithms, we argue, interfere with something in free speech that we tend to overlook, and that is the audience side. We often focus just on the speaker, right? We speak. If we can't say what we want, we say there's a problem with free speech. But speech is more than that. Speech is discourse. Speech is not just saying something, but getting heard. And when there's algorithms that decide what each of us get to see, in reverse, that means that everything that we say and post on social media, an algorithm decides who gets to see it. Some stuff gets amplified, some stuff gets suppressed. And we argue that if we say speech is discourse, then that is a direct interference in free speech. And not just in some speech, the stuff that, you know, we don't want to see on platforms, but in all speech, everything gets basically decided by algorithms, who gets to see what. And we call this phenomenon algorithmic audiencing, because if I speak on social media, algorithms are in between me and the audience. The algorithms make the final decision who gets to see what.
And this algorithmic audiencing happens on all major social media platforms. It's now a standard hidden feature of the digital communications world, and it didn't develop that way by accident.
It didn't used to be like that. When social media started out, what each of us was saying would go to whoever follows us. Or we still have the opportunity to follow people, to befriend people on Facebook, on Twitter. And in the old days, it would just be that. I speak and whoever follows me will get my message, and typically in chronological order. It started with the invention of the like button, and then the idea that, hey, if I know what someone like, we can actually reorder what they get to see based on their preferences. And once you do that, you realize, we can learn so much about preferences of people. We can actually use that to make some money. And when Facebook, for example, went public, they had the pressure from shareholders to actually monetize the platform. And they came up over time, not necessarily by design in the beginning, but over time by learning trial and error with this quite sophisticated way of learning more and more about users, about our preferences, and then using that to feed whatever keeps us most engaged. So it's now not necessarily what we choose to look at and tell the platform our preferences are, but the platforms learn what keeps us most engaged, what gets us to spend more time on the platform, what gets us to give up more of our data, our preferences, and then in turn, what lets them to sell us more targeted advertising, because this is where the money comes from. And unfortunately, a lot of that content that engages us most is stuff that is outrageous or controversial, that gets us really emotional and pumped up.
So in terms of free speech, do you believe this algorithmic audiencing, as you call it, do you believe it's as pernicious as simply censoring speakers, as not allowing people to speak on a platform, say like Twitter or Facebook, for instance?
I think it's different. It's just a new interference in free speech that did not exist in traditional media. So it comes on top of censoring, right? I'm not saying that censorship is not a problem, but if we want to get a handle on free speech on social media, we need to actually look at both. We need to look at censorship and content moderation, and maybe platforms sometimes do overreach. But we also need to look at algorithmic audiencing and the way in which platforms interfere with discourse. And if we understand free speech not just as the right to speak, but as the free and fair exchange of ideas, then certainly those algorithms, through algorithmic audiencing, interfere with that free and fair exchange of ideas, because it's the algorithms that decide. And they decide by the standards of the platform, by whatever gets the platform to, you know, optimize on their metrics, which is engagement and monetization. What we're trying to do is we're trying to actually raise awareness for this so that this becomes part of the discourse around regulation, that algorithms, and there's some understanding that these algorithms do stuff, but what we want to say is that we want to connect what algorithms do to the very idea of free speech. And for that, we need to basically unlearn what free speech is, that it is just the ability to express myself, but that speech is also including the audience, where the free and fair exchange of ideas has to be protected, not just the right to say something.
Are social media companies, are they in any way receptive to this criticism, this suggestion?
Look, I think they are aware of criticism with the algorithms, because we hear quite a bit about algorithmic amplification these days, or algorithmic suppression. The connection to free speech, I think, hasn't been made quite as much. The problem is, however, that it goes straight to their core business, right? If they wanted to do something about this, they would have to actually change the way in which they collect data about us and which they exploit that data in order to drive engagement and therefore make users more interesting for targeted advertising.
From the audience perspective, is there anything the consumer, is there anything that an average person can do to try and minimize this effect?
You can do something. Platforms allow you to reorder your feed in a chronological order, so at least you can change the algorithmic ordering, what is on top of your feed. What you can't really do is change what ends up in your feed in the first place. But even the chronological ordering, some platforms like Facebook, you have to do this every time you log in. For Twitter, I think you can nowadays set this as your default. But we also know that it's, you know, 90-odd% of people never actually change the default on platforms.
It's an interesting idea, this, isn't it? Because when we do tend to think of free speech, we don't tend to think of it as the audience, as the hearer, that they're involved in the promotion or in the establishment of a free speech environment.
Yeah, I think we tend to narrowly focus just on what someone can say. But the discourse is a back and forth, right? Is someone saying something, someone else replying. So it's actually a complex set of messages. And when algorithms amplify certain messages over others, they skew this discourse, right? The whole conversation becomes skewed in quite unpredictable ways, right? It's not like someone steers the conversation in one way or the other. It happens by happenstance, by chance, that these algorithms that optimize for something that helps the platform provider to make more money in the end, then skews the discourse. And research has shown that what gets amplified is often, you know, things that are more extreme, things that enrages us more, things that, you know, tend to engage us more. And I think therein lies the danger, that our democratic discourse, our public discourse, gets skewed in ways that do not reflect where, you know, people's opinions, where people's discourse would otherwise be.
Kai Riemer, a professor of information technology and organization at the University of Sydney.
New ideas, new approaches, new technologies. That's future tense.
Energy, particularly in the form of electricity, is a major topic of discussion in Australia at the moment. Prices have spiked, and there's been talk of a widening supply crisis up and down the heavily populated East Coast, with companies at times threatening to turn out the lights. Things are likely to be different, I hear you say, when renewable forms of energy gain a greater foothold. And by many estimates, Australia has been lagging behind in the transition away from fossil fuels. But could part of the future energy mix include bacteria? Sandra Ray is the founder and CEO of a French company called Glowe, and she's been busy developing a new form of public lighting powered by bioluminescent microorganisms. Sandra Ray.
So what we use is marine bacteria that usually lives inside fish or squids, for example. Our job is basically to use these bacteria, select them, make them evolve to make them more efficient in terms of light production, and then create products that looks like urban furniture to replace traditional lighting in the city. So we really create a new philosophy around lighting to use this new living and liquid light and to create more convivial, social, safe places in the cities, mainly in the pedestrian zones.
So yes, this is about utilising a new natural energy source, one not many of us will have thought of. And yes, this is also about art, about design and aesthetics.
Yeah, it's basically both. And that's what's interesting about lighting is that we tend to think that the lighting market is just about having the best intensity at the lowest price. But lighting is much more than that. It's creating identities. It's creating ambiences. It's also creating social activities. So it's really at the crossroad of art and functional systems.
What's the quality of the light that's produced from this particular process? What does it look like if somebody came across one of your lamps?
So it's a liquid light, so you can immediately see that it's different from what we usually see as light bulbs. It is a liquid that is kind of blue lagoon color, blue-green color. It's a very soft light, and it's moving because inside the systems you have an airflow in order to produce the biochemical reaction of bioessence. So it's basically a liquid moving light. The goal is really to get rid of this traditional approach of having lampposts with one bulb at few meters above the ground and to really think about what do the pedestrian zones need in terms of lighting to be able to be agreeable for people.
So on that point, what's the strength of this type of lighting? How would it compare in lumens, say, to an ordinary LED lamp?
Well, in terms of intensity, of course, it's less bright than a traditional LED. But as the approach is different, you can really use it and replace electric lighting as we know it. Today, we've managed. So at the beginning, when we started, the intensity was so low that you needed 15 minutes in total darkness to basically see something. Today, when you put bioessence under a lamppost, you can see it perfectly at 100 meters. So there is no more issues in terms of lighting, and all the cities today have also worked on preserving biodiversity. And we, of course, know that light has a big impact on how biodiversity acts. So having less intensity is just something that will happen with bioessence or LED anyway, because it's required to preserve biodiversity.
Now, you said this involves marine bacteria. They're alive, of course. So take us through the process. I mean, how do you harvest this bacteria? How do you actually put them in the device and how do you keep them glowing?
So the interesting part about the bacteria is that it grows very fast and you can grow it in the lab. So we don't take anything from the sea anymore. We have some bacteria in the lab and we basically grow them when we need them. You can basically grow your light without spending and taking limited resources from the planet. So that's the first thing. It's really biosourced and you can grow it. So what we do is that as soon as we have the best bacteria that we develop in the lab, we put it in the system. We mix them with a nutrient medium, which is basically close to seawater, to grow the bacteria. And so the bacteria grow inside the furniture itself. And the system is made a bit like an aquarium. So you need to feed the bacteria to make them live and keep producing light. And as soon as you feed them, then they will keep producing light.
Do you have to replace them, the bacteria? What sort of lifespan do they have?
Well, the lifespan of one bacteria is not a lot, but as they're always growing because you feed them, then you have always new populations of bacteria that are able to live and to produce light. So the system is not closed. When there is liquid coming in with nutrients, then there is liquid coming out. So the culture basically gets regulated like that.
Now, you've entered into a partnership, as I understand it, with the city administration in Rambouillet. Could I get you to explain to us what you hope to achieve from that partnership? What are they looking for and what are you looking for?
Yeah, so the public contract that we've signed is really about the first pilot of bioessence urban furniture. So we've been working with them for 2 years. While we were working in the lab to develop the tech, we were working with them to develop the way we can operate the system, the way the technical services of a city can do that in order to create a product that is integrating into the existing infrastructure and organization of the cities, because it's of course very important. Having living light changes a lot of things in the value chain, but we needed to create something that can be used easily by these municipalities. So that was the point. And First Urban Furniture is in production and we're going to test it in a few months for the first time for long periods in the city. And of course, the goal of that pilot project is to validate a certain amount of things, technical, operational, but also the way citizens see this light and live with it. And we're already working with 50 more cities in France to deploy this technology right after the pilot.
Now, this is a much cleaner form of lighting, but it still does require a certain amount of electricity, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does to make the system work. The global environmental impact is very interesting because the first part of being biosourced and not basically today to produce LEDs, you have to go mining rare metals and to then have very heavy industrial process, transformation processes. So this is something that really don't happen in terms of production with biomethane. It's really simple in terms of producing this bacteria. And the second part is that it's biodegradable. So there's no waste produced. It's non-toxic and non-pathogenic for either the environment or humans, which is something that's very important in terms of life cycle. So this is really something that we can work on to reduce the environmental impact of lighting.
Well, Sandra Ray, a terrible pun here, but thank you very much for illuminating us on bioluminescence.
Thank you for inviting me.
You may not have thought much about this, but cities have defined shapes. They're unique in their own ways, but they also tend to develop into several common rough forms. And climatologist Dev Nyogi has been plotting their outlines.
So if you look at cities globally, there are certain patterns that you can start thinking about. I mean, the most classic one being where you have the center of the city and then the ring roads around it and city sort of like expanding around it. So that's one, roughly, I would say, a round central city that has been seen. A second approach is typically where you've seen square cities, where you can think, for instance, Beijing, where you might have a certain road and then a series of roads that are put around it like boxes. And then there are, because of topography or some of the natural features that exist, cities tend to even grow out as almost like in star shapes. You have a center, and then largely because of the railroad or some other metro manner in which the mobility expanded, cities have spawned out into some star-shaped fashion. The other ones, and largely constrained because of some of the topography or any geographical constraints, where you might have a strip of rectangle along the coast. And then in some instances, you have this triangle where you might have hills on the side and the city sort of narrowing it with its front along the most expansive of the real estate, so to say.
And each of those shapes has an impact on the local climate, according to Professor Nyogi's research, and on what he terms storminess. He's the director of the Texas Extreme Weather and Urban Sustainability Lab at the University of Texas.
It has been pretty well established that cities can alter rainfall because of the heat, because of the pollution, and because of the heating that takes place. The second question we had asked was, is there a particular size of the city that really changes the rainfall? And we find typically around the cities which have a footprint of minimum of about 25 kilometers or so, give or take a few here and there, can have the ability to change the storms around it. And so then came the question, is there an impact of particular shape of the city? And so we did some experiments and looked at some data, and looks like the round city model that seems to evolve with cities expanding as a sprawl are the ones that are most likely to change rain around it.
So that's significant, isn't it? If we're talking about climate change and if we can change the shape of the city, does that mean we can increase the potential for rainfall?
That's the hope, that we have thus far been developing cities as if they are completely devoid of how they are changing the climate around it. What we do find is that the manner in which we design our cities, both in terms of the shape and the function and the form, could have an ability to change the climate around it. And one of which certainly looks like the manner in which where and where we could have a certain degree of storminess. And if it so happens that we have even a small chance to increase the rain in places where you actually have the water reservoirs feeding water to the city, then perhaps that should be given a bit more weightage than a design which might be taking water away from such a reservoir.
Is there also evidence that the shape of a city could increase resilience, you know, against things like tornadoes, against things like cyclones, heavy storms?
Funny you ask that. One of the questions we have been looking into recently is exactly that. because we have been studying, is there a particular reason that tornadoes tend to occur just around the periphery of the city, where you have some of those transitionary housing like trailer parks and so forth? And what we are trying to understand now is what aspect of the city structure, whether it is the buildings followed by trees, followed by buildings, makes it more resilient, or is it long swaths of green patches with buildings, with water, and a mixed land use which can make it more resilient? At this point, looks like the mixed land use, where you have a residential, commercial greenery and an ability of the city to be within everything and everywhere, seems to be a good model going forward. I think mobility is the key, and access to facilities within a very finite short distance is not only good for livability, but it is also good for resiliency.
So this research has quite significant implications, doesn't it, for urban planning, for the way we design our cities and urban areas in future?
That is our hope. I mean, it is clearly, when we look at how cities are being designed today versus how cities were designed, say, 50 or 100 years back, I am not really sure that we have seen such a revolution in the manner in which cities are being designed by the consideration of climate. When you compare that to the amount of the tremendous information that we have now been able to garner about how cities change climate and how climate is changing. And so it is quite critical that, looking forward, that our future cities are both climate resilient as well as designed in manner in which they are part of the climate ecosystem.
Have you had interest or feedback from urban planners, from city administrators?
We are working with certain groups where we are trying to develop technology and we are trying to develop data sets. Climate is just one part of the city. City are essentially engines of economy and culture. And as you can imagine, there are multiple things that city planners need to plan for and they have to account for. But certainly I've been pretty optimistic about the notion that city planners are looking at this kind of information with renewed interest. And I think the more data, the more information, the kind we are discussing today, comes into the mainstream, the more it is likely that it will become a part of how cities are being designed in the future.
And if we're talking about, you know, increasing resilience within a city, or indeed trying to attract more water to that city, how difficult would it be to retrofit, you know, a significant size city, a city that's sprawled for a long time and has a distinct shape?
Cities are by nature human aspects. They were not there. They were created. So cities are essentially at the mercy of the human design. And so however we design, cities are going to shape up. What is really important is the intent here. As long as we come up with the intent that we are going to make our cities more green, they're going to be more climate resilient, and they are going to be much more livable in the context of where we are seeing this increasing hazards, we are going to see a cascade of small to large changes that can start occurring, whether it is from the context of saying having more green spaces or having more engineering material being used, which is good for lowering the heat, or we are going to have a design in which we are going to have a consideration about the feedbacks it has on how birds are going to be flying, or how the winds are going to be created, or the manner in which pollution is going to spread, or how storms are going to be formed. And all of this is extremely possible. All we need is a will and an understanding, and we are on path to that.
Professor Dev Niyogi from the Extreme Weather and Urban Sustainability Lab in Texas. And finally, a promising development in the world of virtual reality and online simulation. One of the goals, of course, has been to make an experience as immersive as possible. And researchers at the University of Chicago have been working on a new haptics approach that they believe can do just that. Researcher Jasmine Liu.
So haptics and the field of haptics is generally interested in how to reproduce touch sensations, whether that's for rendering them in things like virtual reality so that we can have physical contact with virtual experiences and not just visual contact with virtual experiences. And a lot of the field is interested in creating devices that stimulate the skin or stimulate other areas of the body to create these touch sensations.
And you focus on chemical haptics And my understanding is that traditionally that's been done through the nose and smell, but you've taken a different approach, haven't you?
Yes. So we looked at applying chemicals to the skin specifically to induce haptic sensations. I know that's kind of a crazy idea, or it may seem like that, but it's actually pretty familiar in a lot of products in like drugstores, like hot and cold patches. Hot and cold patches also similarly deliver chemicals to the skin, like capsaicin and menthol, to induce those sensations. So we took that concept and explored a few other chemicals to similarly induce sensations on the skin. So there's 6 chemicals that we looked at specifically, and a lot of these chemicals you'll probably be familiar with in other contexts. So I'll just go ahead and list them out. So menthol, which corresponds to a cooling sensation, you may be more familiar with that in the form of peppermint. A lot of gums use it for a refreshing feeling. Capsaicin is another chemical which is used to induce a warming or hot sensation. Most people are familiar with capsaicin in the form of chili peppers. Another one is senshul, which is derived from Sichuan peppercorns. In a lot of Chinese cuisine, it induces a kind of numbing, tingling sensation on the lips. Another one is lidocaine, which a lot of people are probably familiar with for numbing feelings when you go to the doctor. And last one is cinnamaldehyde, which is a derivative of cinnamon. And that one we use to induce stinging sensations on the skin.
Now tell us about the wearable device that you've built. What is it and how does it work?
Yeah, so we built 2 wearable devices. One was to stimulate the skin on the forearm and one was to stimulate the skin on the cheeks. They're different looking devices, but they both have a very similar concept, which is to use silicone patches that have channels to pump chemical compounds through the channels and deposit them on the skin so that they can be absorbed by the skin directly. And we chose these 2 locations to kind of show how these patches can act as a sort of second skin, just delivering these chemical compounds to render these haptic sensations. And because these chemicals are liquids, they're not very bulky actuators, and you can kind of envision them sitting anywhere on the skin. One thing that we see as a huge advantage of this approach is that by just having a silicone patch and a pumping system, you can change out the different chemical compounds to render a variety of different sensations with one kind of wearable device, instead of having to have a wearable device that includes vibromotors for mechanical stimulation, like Peltier elements, which produce hot and cold temperature. So all of these kind of are condensed into one system. You just have to replace the chemical compound that it's using.
So the obvious application for this is gaming, isn't it? Online gaming or virtual reality experiences. Do you see other applications though?
We primarily explored it for virtual reality, which gaming is a pretty direct application. We also see it useful for training simulations. So when we want to render more realistic touch sensations, one example that we kind of like to give is that what if we want to do a safety training where a person might be exposed to extreme environments like extreme hot or extreme cold? Applying this method of these haptic sensations might help someone undergoing this simulation so that they know not to freak out when they experience these extreme conditions.
Jasmine Liu from the University of Chicago. And Jasmine is a researcher with the Human Computer Interaction Lab. For details about the other guests we heard from today, just go to the Future Tense website. Karin Savanovitz is my co-producer. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.